has written, oh, I'm going to guess now, five or so emails to John and Wes, and I guess to Glenn and me, which go on for about two or three pages with lots of very good information that's well researched. I'm a little bit disappointed that Roy doesn't yet feel he has enough equipment at his QTH, a high enough antenna and enough transmitter power that he can put in a clean signal to this repeater. That's, I think, the reason why we haven't heard Roy's voice alive on the repeater yet. Let me drop it. I think Roy is slowly moving in the direction of his roof is being replaced, and I believe he is going to have some antennas installed on the roof, so he has better coverage. Roy's distance to the repeater and my distance to the repeater are almost identical. And so I talked to this repeater by way of 100 feet of tower and antennas on that tower. Roy doesn't have 100 feet of tower yet, but we're going to see, John and I and Wes are going to see what we can do about that. So that's something about Roy. Roy will take quite a few of the TechNet conversations, like for instance, last week, where Caroline, the 8.5-year-old lady who wrote the question about photo pressure from the sun and whether or not it changes the weight of the stuff in the room when you open the window and sunlight shines in. That's a very innocent-sounding question. Roy actually researched that for us and found out that solar pressure, the photon portion of solar pressure, is 9 nanopascals. Normal air pressure is 100,000 pascal. A pascal is a newton of force per square meter of area. That's the way you measure in the MKS system, in the standard metric system. You measure pressure in pascals, newtons per square meter. I mean, we for years have lived with pounds per square inch as pressure, but the real worldwide accepted one is pascals, and 100,000 pascals, 100,000 newtons of air pressure on each square meter is more than normal air pressure. And now you compare that to 9 nanopascals. That's 1 billionth, or almost 1 billionth of a pascal.
Repeater, timeout.
1 billionth, a little bit more than a billionth of a pascal, whereas normal air pressure is 100,000 pascals. So you can see we're talking about, 9 and 5, 14. 14 orders of magnitude is the difference between solar pressure and normal air pressure. So Roy did some research on that, and the very next morning, after Caroline asked us that question, I heard two guys on the Limog 450 repeater, 449-125, discussing with each other, when I transmit 50 watts out of my Yagi antenna on 450 megacycles and I aim it to the west, the kickback of the antenna is how many newtons? Although it's of academic interest, if you have an interest in science, that is a reasonable question. When Voyager transmits its signal, it's a 10-watt signal, a 20-watt signal, with its 8-foot diameter dish, or 10-foot diameter dish, on 8.5 gigahertz, when it transmits that signal toward the Earth to communicate with us, does that pressure on the dish, because of the radio transmission, change the trajectory of the Voyager spacecraft? And the answer is definitely yes. Voyager and almost every other spacecraft, let me drop this. Almost every spacecraft we've ever launched, you have to calculate the amount of solar wind pressure and radiation photon pressure you get from the sun, and what is it going to do to disturb the trajectory that you have chosen for that spacecraft that you're flying to Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, or whatever. Now, when it comes to coils of wire around a magnetic core, or when it comes to charge in amperes per second that you put into a capacitor, and when it comes to charge you put into a battery, all three of these are various kinds of energy storage devices. I can put some number of joules of energy into my car battery. And on a good day, maybe I can get 85% of the energy back out of the car battery. I can put some number of joules of energy into my favorite capacitor, and if it has very low leakage, I might get 97% of my energy back out of that capacitor. I can put some number of amps of current, store some number of joules of energy in my favorite inductor. And every inductor has wire around it, which has got some series resistance. So you're storing energy in an inductor by way of the stored magnetic field. The magnetic field, by Faraday's law, builds up as you pour current into that coil around your favorite core. Let me drop. And now, when you allow that magnetic field to recollapse, that's basically what happens in your spark coil of the ignition system of your automobile. You put current into the primary, you store a certain amount of magnetic field, you interrupt that current, the magnetic field collapses, the secondary winding that's got more turns generates, let me pick a number, 20,000 volts. That goes across the resistor that's in series with your spark plug.
Can you hear me?
I hear you very well. Go ahead.
I want to interrupt you for about 45 seconds. I'm going to download something and not do anything.
All right, Dodger. We'll stand by while you do your changes to the system. We'll wait until you re-inform us.
Give me a call in a second. K2RIWKKDA. Okay, Dick, you got it.
Okay, I think you said you wanted me to call you. I made a couple of attempts.
Did you accept it?
Yeah, I'll go there. Go there in a minute. Paul, did you have to, here we go. Eric, did you have to replace a fuse, Eric?
Yeah, well, you know about...
And by the way, my message board is open, so you can send me a message if you wanted to. Glenn, go right ahead with your comment. KC2QIQ, and when you finish, I'm going to go back and finish the rest of my comment. I only went through about 80% of it. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, very good, Nick. I really didn't want to interrupt you before, but just, there's a little break. It's a little bit about history of, or some of the definition of photon pressure. It's kind of interesting. I might just want to throw this in because we talked about it before. That if you look at photon pressure, most of that's a conversion factor from the energy. And if you look at even how it's calculated, how it really comes about, it assumes that you have a light ray, a vertical light ray coming down onto a planar surface. And Earth has an emissivity of zero. That's right, zero. You know, because if it had an emissivity of one, all energy would be absorbed. Nothing would be reflected. So assuming zero, you're assuming that all is reflected. So that makes you think again, what in the world is this photon pressure then? It's really the energy conversion of the photon at the moment that is at the surface of a mass at the point of contact. So this way you have the energy that you can measure at that point. But it's also very, very associated to the frequency of the light as it approaches that surface. So frequency is important, the understanding that the emissivity is zero. So back to the K2RIWKKDA.
Yeah, good point. I think it's Planck's equation, which relates wavelength to energy, E equals H nu, is the usual way it's represented. H, I think, is Planck's constant. So as you go to higher frequencies, shorter wavelengths, I may have that backwards. No, H nu is frequency. As you go to higher frequencies, each photon contains more energy. One of the examples that's used in that beautiful book, Thinking Physics, I'll think of his name in a minute, the author. It's a paperback book for about $30. If you see it in your local bookstore, buy it. Thinking Physics, an extremely well done book can't think of his name. Anyhow, and that book is in its 27th printing, third edition. Obviously, it's popular. And they keep underestimating how many people are going to buy it. They don't run the press with a big enough number, and they got to keep doing it again, over and over again. That's why it's in his 27th printing. Anyhow, one of his examples in there is that you're going to use either steel bullets or rubber bullets. Common sense would lead you to believe that if the bullets have the exact same mass, and if your gun issues them with the same velocity, you would assume that total amount of energy conveyed to something with a steel bullet would be greater than the rubber bullet. It's backwards. Assuming now that you're hitting something with a steel bullet where the steel bullet penetrates and stays there, that gives you a certain amount of delta momentum to the thing that was hit. Assume now it's a spongy object that's on a car with ideal wheels, and the car is going to speed up because you've hit it with a steel bullet that penetrated and stuck. And then you repeat the experiment, and you use a rubber bullet which bounces off. The car will develop twice as much momentum with a rubber bullet, because the rubber bullet went in, eventually came to a stop, it hit the object, came to a...
RC210, repeater, controller, V6.03.
Okay, looks like we're back in operation. I guess Eric had to replace another fuse. Reboot the computer. When the rubber bullet bounces off your object, the rubber bullet has to first hit the object, come to zero, then reverse in direction and go back to where it came from, so to speak. You get twice as much momentum out of something that bounces as opposed to something that's absorbed. So therefore, what I think you're saying, Glenn, is that if the photon energy is hitting a black surface which has absorption capability, you get one amount of momentum issued. But if it hits a mirrored surface, where all of it gets bounced away, you get twice as much momentum from the photon energy hitting a mirrored surface. That's what I think you were saying, but you were using different vocabulary. KC2WG, here we go. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, Greg Glenn.
What it's really kind of saying is that when you have a solar pressure on there, is when it's something in between. It's not a zero and it's not a one. You think that where you probably have a maximum of solar pressure that actually pressed against the device or that surface would be somewhere around one half of that. But I would have to look at the math on that one more time to find out exactly where the maximum pressure is. I would assume it's either somewhere between 0.5 and 0.707, somewhere in between that area.
If I was using the bullet example, rubber bullet versus the steel bullet, one gets absorbed, one gets bounced, and they're both the same mass and the same velocity of bullet, you would believe that the higher the reflectivity, the greater the amount of momentum, which really results in the greatest amount of force. So the better the mirrored surface, a surface that has a reflectivity of unity, which is absorptivity of zero, you would think would have the greatest amount of solar pressure exerted. To my knowledge, the solar sails they put up in space are aluminized pieces of plastic where they're trying to make maximum reflectivity. Over to you, Eric. Here we go. Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, here again is the city. They're trying to make it... I don't think that they're trying to make perfect mirror surfaces, Dick. I think what they're doing is they're trying to make a semi-mirror surface. And also, depending on the striking angle, is also important as well. So, in other words, you don't really want a 90-degree pitch. You want to have something off of 90 degrees, and you want to have something that's not exactly a mirror finish. K2RIW, K2QIQ.
Glenn, what is the advantage of not being a mirrored surface? You would think if you wanted the maximum force, you're not trying to steer to the left or the right, you're just trying to build that pure velocity. If I had a 90-degree reflection angle and a 100% mirrored surface, why would that not give me the maximum force? Because now all the photons hitting that mirrored surface are being bounced back, very similar to the rubber bullet. Over to you, Glenn.
How do you get a perfectly mirrored surface in space?
Very carefully. That's what they do on the surface of telescope mirrors, Glenn. They try to make the telescope mirrored surface on the parabolic reflector. They'd like to get 98% reflectivity if they can do it.
I would think that they'd probably try to get as much as reasonably possible, and then to correct for it, put a pitch on the plane to the light that's hitting. So in other words, you want to have control over the pitch.
In order to do navigating and steering left and right, I agree with you. But if you just want pure velocity buildup and maximum force, why wouldn't you make the reflection angle 90 degrees, in other words, normal? And why wouldn't you make the mirrored surface as highly reflective as possible? Over to you, Glenn.
I think there's also something else involved here, too, but I think if it was just the solar pressure alone that was doing it, excluding other forces, there was thermal forces and other things, I would say that what you're saying is correct. But I think that there's other things involved there as well. So there are some thermal properties and some other things going on. So it's kind of a mixed bag going on there.
You did hit an interesting subject there. They discovered that every time they do very, very careful measurements of Voyager, they found out that the rate at which it moved away from the sun was different than the prediction. And after a whole lot of study of a whole lot of past data, they came to the conclusion that the electronics on board, which is behind the dish, is creating heat. The heat reflected off of the dish being bounced into space was creating another force of thrust, very, very small, but when you do it for 30 some odd years, it built up to being a trajectory error. So the heat coming off of Voyager, the backside of the dish, is changing its trajectory. So I think you're saying that there might be a way of making your solar sail partially absorptive so that it gets hot, and now if you can control which direction it re-radiates that heat. Now there's a little bit of a problem. If I made it a partially mirrored surface so that my solar sail becomes hot, and now I'm doing more radiation of the heat off the back surface than the front surface, it seems like the extra thermal thrust I'm going to get is in the wrong direction. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
I don't want to step too much into a topic that I probably shouldn't discuss too much, but I can tell you that you can correct that by making two different surfaces of the sail, different contrasts, so different emissivity, but I don't want to take too much further than that. K2RWK2QIQ.
Yeah, when it comes to building a satellite you put into space, you have to be very careful with how you paint the surface, so to speak. Absorptivity to emissivity ratio. Depending on what the surface of your spacecraft is, strongly determines what thermal, what temperature it's finally going to settle on in space. Because the backside of your satellite is looking at dark space at roughly 2.73 degrees Kelvin, and the front side is looking at the sun and absorbing solar energy. So if you're not careful, you can have a very hot front side and a very cold back side. And so by rolling the satellite, you can do the rotor broil kind of mode, you can partially correct that. You can put heat pipes in it and other kinds of heat sinks to control, to do thermal conductivity between backside and front side. You got to really worry about these things because your batteries don't want to be frozen or don't want to be boiled. Your electronics has very reasonably narrow temperature range over which it gives you full performance. Cameras, motors, lubricants, they all have their critical temperature range where they work well. You got to be careful about that. Let me drop. But now, the tail end of what I was saying before is that when I put magnetic energy into a coil, into an inductor, it is the joules of energy are stored in that magnetic field. The very first guy who did this was Faraday. Michael Faraday, way back in the early 1800s, I think it was, he fabricated a ring of magnetic material. He put a winding on the magnetic ring. Let me say that the winding started at 10 o'clock and went over to 2 o'clock, not multiple turns of wire. And in those days, you couldn't just go to a store, couldn't go to Radio Shack and pick up enameled wire. He had to find wire, find a way of insulating the wire, then wrap it onto this core. And then he did the same thing with another coil of wire between, let's say, 4 o'clock and 8 o'clock. Down at the bottom, he had another coil of wire. The first coil of wire, you and I could call it the primary. The second coil of wire, you and I could call it the secondary. He had a battery with a switch that he put across the primary. He had a galvanometer, which really is a milliammeter with a with a zero center on it, he had a galvanometer on the secondary winding. He recognized that when he closed the switch and applied battery current into the primary winding, at first the needle of the galvanometer connected to the secondary winding would tick to the right and then come back to zero, even though he's continuing to pour current into the primary. Then he opened up the switch on the primary, and he watched the needle in the secondary tick to the left. So he rapidly came to the conclusion that the rate of change of magnetic field inside of a coil of wire determines the amount of voltage that's created. We now call that Faraday's law. And Faraday's law has a lot of applications when it comes to antennas and power supplies and whatever. Here's my point. Let me drop it. Nobody, to my knowledge, has ever found a crafty way of putting stored magnetic energy into a coil of wire and getting that magnetic energy back out at even equal to the amount you put in. You never get back 100%. And so by having multiple windings that oppose each other, around each other, clockwise, counterclockwise, and whatever, and various pulse waveforms, there's a zillion ways you can fool yourself. There's a whole bunch of YouTube videos of guys with rotary machines using neodymium magnets in which they measure what they thought was the voltage going in, and they thought they measured the current going in, and they measured the voltage coming out and the current coming out, and they thought they were getting above unity power. At first, with simple measurements, it looked like that was the truth. But when you start including power factor, what was the phase angle of the current going in? What's the phase angle of the current coming back out? When you include power factor and do it correctly, and do it with true RMS metering as opposed to simple metering, a simple Dawson Bell movement that measures current or measures voltage, it doesn't measure RMS, it measures average. Under certain kinds of waveforms, there's a huge difference between the real amount of energy being represented in a true RMS meter versus an averaging meter. So there's a whole bunch of YouTube videos in which neodymium magnet rotary machinery looks like it's giving above unity power. And I'm reasonably sure it's not real. There's a power factor problem. I can have a machine that's absorbing 1300 volt amperes, but because of the power factor, in other words, the machine is primarily inductive, therefore the current flowing through the machine does not follow the voltage waveform. So therefore my 1300 volt amperes might really only be 1000 watts of power that I'm putting into that machine. And so, particularly now if I was playing it backwards, if that was a motor generator set, and I was getting 1300 volt amperes out, and I'm only putting 1000 watts in, I would think I'm getting more than unity. So, I'm having trouble believing that a magnetic circuit, a capacitive circuit, a battery circuit, can ever give us more out than we put in. Conservation of energy, if you know what I mean. There are various ways you can run an experiment. You can even get patents filed and patents granted, which appear to do that. You don't have to build a working model anymore to get a patent. So the fact that somebody has patented something doesn't yet prove that what he's done is traceable to the mirror, if you know what I mean. I know that I didn't address exactly what you said, Wes, but as you can tell, I start off from a skeptical point of view. I know that an awful lot of the writings of Roy, AC2GS, have a similar philosophy to them. N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
I'm so thankful to you and to all of the guys that collaborate with me from the traditional science standpoint. And that helps me a lot, actually. What I'm trying to say is that I see a certain phenomena, and that phenomena based on the visual science I imparted. In that particular coil, that was a video that was made, and 4.6 watt was drawn by the device with no loads, and 4.6 watt plus 500 microamps was drawn when the 8 watt load was connected. So traveling, create induction in those coils where those coils are connected to load, and that energy is dissipated. But on its way back, when the simple single impulse is traveling in the counterclockwise manner, at that point is canceling the inductance and the magnetic field. Therefore, there is no interaction. So we're not talking about over unity, we're talking about close to unity scenario, that's based on my belief. And then we have something that I call electrostatic pump, which being less scientifically, I would say, is sucking electrons from the ground. Although it's controversial, we're going to the Roy statement, Roy quote, reading the failed patent application, because I was mentioning with a patent of another guy. You're reading, I have no idea what is low mass electrons, what low mass electrons mean. What is it, lower than the ground state? What does this actually mean? In the presence of magnetic fields, we have two factors, speed of the electron and the mass of the electron. In 1901, despite the fact that Kaufmann knew, and Kaufmann was the one who actually was very much known fundamental physicist, this guy had made a very simple experiment. He put radium, and he created beta particles, and he was observing beta particles in a magnetic field. His statement is, the mass of the electrons that constitutes the Becquerel rays, which is the beta radiation, which would be a single electron or unphased electron, depends on velocity. The dependency can be demonstrated exactly by the formula of Abram, where therefore the mass of electrons is purely of electromagnetic nature. Then there is another photograph that is also in your mailbag. Kaufmann published data in 1903, which actually brought the attention of Abram, Boucher, Lawrence, and plenty of others. The conclusion, which is extremely controversial. The prevalent results decidedly speak against correctness of Lawrence's assumption, as well as Einstein's assumption. Even at the account that one considers the basic assumption refuted, then one would be forced to consider it as a failure. To attempt to base that the entire field of physics, including electrodynamics and optics, upon the principle of relative movement. A choice between the theory of Abram and Boucher for the time being is impossible, and does not seem to be attainable by observation of the time described. The reason that I'm drawing is because in official physics we have, the link is in your mailbox, as the electrons orbit, they accelerate, so they lose energy by radiation, therefore slow down, their orbit decreases. Of course, it must be remembered that the electric force acts along the line of the electric field direction, while the magnetic force acts at right angles to the field direction. So, charged particle rate expires at force in electrical field, but not in magnetic field. Strangely enough, everything is related to the coil that I started in the video that we're talking about. Another photo that is sent to you guys says, electrons in magnetic field coil determine the mass of an electron. However, the charge and mass ratio of the electron, both of the charge and the mass of electrons, are fundamental constants of considerable importance. However, since the force of the charged particle moving in the electric magnetic field is proportional to the charge of the particle, and from the Newton law, the mass time acceleration, only the ratio of the charge to mass can be determined by observing the motion of the particle in electric and magnetic fields. The only charge and mass ratio for the amount of electrons. That's the statement of the guy who fired the button. His button failed. The other button that was using a coil, that is magnifying coil, was approved a few days ago. I spoke to the gentleman. He's 85 years old, and I had a quite interesting discussion with him. As you know, most of those guys in the group that I'm happy to participate with are close to 70, over 70. And you can see what those people's minds could bring up on the table. The low mass electrons produce greater inductive energy output than their kinetic energy input. And most conduction electrons of the semiconductors and the superconductors possess the subnormal mass. That's his statement, whether it's true or false, we don't care about it. But we care about something that he brings as the equation. He was able to calculate that because of low mass energy, low mass energy electrons accelerate faster than normal electrons, they radiate extra energy from the acceleration they receive. That would be Lymer 1. Equation that showed that the proton A's energy radiates from the moving charge in the proportion to the square of its acceleration. That would be pretty much obvious for the superconductors. Now, further down, he says that the lower mass energy electrons could be accelerated 10,000 times faster than normal in centripetal acceleration, true-like acceleration, and they create about 1 million times more energy than they possess because of the movement. Of course, this thing is kind of ridiculous to even think about, but he further down postulates a supercurrent that took out 4 hours of charge was projected by the computer and took 130 years to decline exponentially from calculated 46 amps to 16 amps. As expected, the discharge is about 100,000 times longer than the charging time. Anyhow, looks like I'm reading the fairy tale.
About 2 minutes.
Thank you. Looks like I'm reading fairy tales, but I brought to you something that, despite the fact of that button, the observation of the most of those machines for me is, or at least seems like, to be legitimate. The only that the methods and the mechanisms are not fully understood. That's why I'm in it. And my understanding is that I brought important factor about controversy over the mass of an electron and in regards to the speed in a magnetic field and to examine the specs.
You've used the word low-mass electron, low-mass electrons, less a few times. And as you know, a man who studies particle physics, I'm not one, I'm guessing would give you a fair amount of pushback on that statement that we've been measuring electrons, their charge, their mass, the charge-to-mass ratio for over 100 years. And
look at your email. I gave you all of the resources, and not only the controversial resources, but pretty much the next one, giving you the dependency of the mass versus speed in magnetic field.
So, the meaning of that material, I think you're saying, Wes, it has led you to believe that there is something called a low-mass electron. There's lots of them. And I think you're saying that their mass to it their mass is something like 100,000 times lower than ordinary electrons. You know that's going to be a little hard to sell in at the Bureau of Standards, Wes. Go ahead.
Of course you're right. The thing is that I'm giving you the information. instruction for you to act on it. That means you can read it. Roy definitely is going to do it. And I appreciate that. Most of that stuff that is in the patent application or is in the material of this gentleman, of the patent that I'm quoting, something that might not necessarily bring you to agree with it, but the other sources actually state about the fact of dependency of the mass versus the speed. And even John can tell you right now that that there is a dependency of mass versus the speed. John, pick up.
Yeah, before John picks up, I'm going to put in our closing comments that you guys have been listening to TechNet number 1517 of the TechNets that began way back in September of 1982. Keep up your curiosity. Keep up asking questions. Keep up your enthusiasm. Radio and wireless has got a lot to offer. You ain't heard nothing yet. Just turn it over to John for his comments on all of the above. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Of it.
electrons, protons, neutrons, quarks, and hadrons, and everything else. For a whole bunch of reasons, we're never going to see a picture of those. So the best that we have is a mental model of what we think it looks like if we could make a picture of it. And that mental model keeps changing in time. And oh, by the way, it's getting more and more complicated. So we've got a long way to go as to what's really happening at the atomic level. I'm going to have to leave you, Wes, and I'll look at your emails, and I'll try to look at your YouTube videos, or your videos that you've mailed. And so we'll try to pick this up next week. Into XJN, KQLIW.
Thank you very much. Also, take a look at the, before the last one, email of Roy, where he is bringing the article, Electron in Magnetic Fields, Reveal Surprises. And this one is basically talking about Landau states of electrovortex beams, which actually is about these swirling electrons around the common center like a tornado, and that would be kind of the rotation that describes three fundamental forces or speed of rotation, which would be a cyclotron frequency, zero frequency, and the Lymer frequency. Frequency would be a half of the speed of the frequency, I mean, half of the frequency of the cyclotron frequency. Anyhow, there's plenty of interesting things about the electron behavior in the magnetic field. I'm not saying that I agree with everything that I read, but at least I'm more optimistic, and the only difference between you guys and me is that you are pessimistic. And the more pessimistic you are, the more you're helping me out. Thank you very much.
If you get a chance, don't forget to watch that Titanic video.
I fully intend to. And I've been doing tower work these days, but that's slowing down, and yes, bye-bye you all.
Thank you very much, guys. And have a good night. Ciao.
Thanks. Good day today. First busy. Got a lot of things done. So, what'd you do today?
I went downstairs, and I was trying to open the drawer from that $25 and $63 with all of the charges. Beta imager. I wasn't really successful. It's a big air cylinder with kind of clutch that's keeping in one position and needs electricity to be released to be slowed down. But anyhow, was listening to, or was watching what's going on to the Ukraine. Alas. So what did you accomplish?
I was working on my radiance flux meter today, and I found out something interesting, trying to determine what RF spectrum it covers. I was talking to Dick the other night, and I've covered the optical range, which it does very well, infrared, and all different color spectrums it does. But it also detects RF, but I don't know its full range, and that's what I'm trying to determine. And I don't have a book or any instructions on this thing, so I looked on the internet. It's very difficult to find anything about it. Very special meter that was made by HP.
Okay. I have another one, military one, that is a spectroscopy device that is operating somewhere in the vicinity of the visible light and ultraviolet, I believe. But I'm not sure. Yeah. Now, I could bring to you that toy, because I don't have the time to play with all of it. It's a fully complete one with the small vacuum pump, and is for you to the behavior in particular wavelength of the specimen. You could play with this as long as you can, or you want to, and it's not complicated. It's very much basic, but it's absolutely magnificent piece of hardware. That's very great. Thank you. short copy device. It works not with the X-ray, not with the beta, not with the gamma, not with the alpha, but it works with near visible light wavelength spectrum.
Well, I don't really know what I would do with that. What kind of a display does it have? What is it actually? Is it a meter reading, or is it a video display panel? What is the indicator?
The meter of the reading. It does have a two dials, if I remember correctly. I have a some instruction to it. I got it in the huge military suitcase, and I took the suitcase for other purposes. Right now in my basement, I played with it for the moment. It does have the optics, and it is capable of creating a vacuum. It's a spectrometer. I mean, I can look at it and try to give you a model number and what it does.
No, that's all right. Don't put yourself out. No, Jack. I'm just trying to think what I would do with it. Why you need a vacuum to observe light in the optical wavelength?
Oh, Jack. The molecules of air, there are physical bodies moving around. They create a vacuum. They are creating a quite different environment for the response of the light waves in vacuum and their behavior.
Oh, okay. So, don't want your light impinging on the contamination, so they want a vacuum. Sort of understand that.
Yeah. Now, from other things, usually when there is a technet and you guys talking about different kind of things and I'm preparing myself at 11 o'clock, I'm supposed to be there and ready. So I'm reading different kind of stuff and then I'm building that theory, or I'm building that, like from the blocks, that electrostatic pump mechanism and all of the processes that are assigned to it. I'm trying to put in one bucket all of those TKs and Aquas and all other stuff, devices, as they are pretty much similar in nature. I believe the guy from the last video made a great contribution not knowing about it. What he did is just, he put two light bulbs, he used the two charts of the oscilloscope, and there was no significant change when the load was connected or was not connected. Now, I was also thinking about what Roy told me. Roy was questioning, actually he says I'm trying to square the circle, but he was questioning my idea about 15 girls. But I believe the 15 girls pushing one car is gotta be put into one particular scenario in order to understand it perfectly. Was questioning the statement, the faster you go, the less energy you need to compensate your losses. So if you got Roy's email, you can read it. I don't believe that he fully understood what I was mentioning to. What I'm saying is there is no way that we're going to go to opportunity with that. It is only that by the 15 girls pushing at first the car, we accumulating the energy, we're storing the energy. And then one girl pushing it with one finger, and then with the nail of the finger, is that much as needed to compensate the losses. So the faster you go on the straight line, theoretically, the more, the less compensating energy you need, because the energy is being stored. But we're not going to over-unity with that, we're not even going to unity with that. And that's the point at which employing the electrostatic pump. And then I was giving you the example about the man sucking from the tubing and then creating the water flow. But his motion, his force was only temporary impulse that was giving the water flow because of the gravity. So yes, he was unity, it would be addition of the energy at the big number. That's why I concentrated myself on the speed of electrons and the behavior of electrons and also the state of the electrons in terms of charge. That means when you have ionized aurora, what is going over there? How does particles behave? Are they pulled in or they pushed out? Are they trying to gather, hey guys, let's go together because we are so happy being ionized, or they try to create enlarge the distance so they have the same charge. Andrew, to you.
Yeah, well, that whole thing with the 15 girls and the one girl, I have a lot of problems with that analogy doesn't work for me, and reduction of effort doesn't happen. I mean, if you want to remove all friction, air friction, bearing friction, support, any kind of drag, yeah, well, then you don't need anybody pushing it. Once you get it going, it will continue forever, you know, until something happens to stop it. So that's not a very good analogy. All the other things you talked about, yeah, you have to realize that electrons can only occupy certain shell radio dimensions from the core or the nucleus. It can't be anywhere else but in certain radio distances from the nucleus. So if you add energy to an electron, it will go to a larger radius. Now, we have the spin of the electron. We have its orbital velocity. And what are you changing? So if you have an electron that's near the center, all right, you want to call that the low energy electron. But I agree with you, if you can slow an electron down, its effective mass is reduced. If you speed it up, its effective mass is increased. But I don't see any advantage to applying that to what you're saying.
Okay. Intuition. Well, John, let's first about the 15 gears. You're right and Roy is right. You cannot create a state in which the stored energy will not be utilized, because you need to still to have a constant pumping of the energy in order to sustain the state. Talking about a temporary situation, 15 gears push the car, one gear is supporting the movement of the car with her nails after a certain period of time, not even the finger. And then the temporary state is introduced to the electrostatic pump. And the electrostatic pump, the most dumb way that I could describe it is, you suck the water, you suck the hose in order for you to create a flow of the liquid, let's say. You use only one impulse in order for the liquid to flow. And of course, the liquid is not going to flow all the time, it's going to be temporary state of it. But you didn't really get tired with it. That's what I'm saying, ladies and gentlemen. And to explain. So then, it is flowing. So you're having a state of matter, of the state of that device that is already in need for a small amount of energy to compensate to perpetual motion. It's never going to happen. And then you're creating a state of over-unity, which is not over-unity. It is only over-unity to the side eye, to somebody who is watching from the side. Because of a sudden you have a big energy flow. So that's the theoretical explanation how that would be used. That's very clear.
Well, don't forget, if you had a vessel and you filled it with water, and you had a cork with a little hole at the bottom, you would have to suck it. Just pull a cork out, you'll get the same result. So it's run out of water. So that's the gravity. Now, what would happen if you were in a zero gravity situation and you pulled the cork out? Water would probably stay in the vessel.
But we're talking about a temporary state of everything. Your life, my life, is temporary state of matter. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. Even the universe is temporary. Depending on what scale you look at.
Okay. The half-life or the decaying of unhappy nuclei. Very much unhappy nuclei. called a isotope, and this thing needs to be balanced. We have something that is extremely amazing in the universe. Everything wants to be in balance and to exceed.
I look at it a little differently. Everything really wants to be in chaos. That's what the position of chaos, so that's what entropy is all about. It's on its way to change.
No, I would say quite different way, John. There is a state of balance that is the personally assigned. So let's say, Russia wants to be in balance, so they invade another country. America wants to have a control of the fuel. So for America to be in balance, there is a need for this balance. Now we physically would say that, we would say, balance creates this balance. So the balance creates high chaos. So the balance is only point in time organized structure. And to achieve.
Well, I don't know how you're proving a fuel. That seems really not going to make any sense. But we're looking at time dilation, we're looking at entropy, it follows time. So everything, the whole thing about order and chaos is the fact that it is what direction. I don't see it the same way you do.
I see it as balance in chaos. It's point of interest. Point of interest, balance creates most balance. It's energy exchange. Interesting.
Okay, but when you say energy change, energy changing to what? And to be able to have a decay of energy is normal. And it will dissipate. I'm going to disappear, but it will dissipate. How do you capture dissipating energy and funnel it back to the original point to keep it going forever?
Nothing is forever. Yeah, I was talking about energy exchange. Energy exchange can happen because of change of the form. Changing from one form to the other. You have a decaying matter, which would be in life of 2,000 years, whatever. And then, of a sudden, it comes to the balance. Now, one would say, okay, we have that after 2,000 years, we have that particular isotope in balance. What happened to the particles or the energy that was emitted from that particular specimen? It must have get somewhere and be converted to something. So what I'm saying is, balance is only when we look at one particular point